Welcome back, my friends. This is Henrik Palmgren, your host, coming to you live from the windy west coast of Sweden. Thank you for tuning in to bbsradio.com. This is Red Ice Radio. And don't forget to check out our website. It's red-ice.net. News, links, and research, all about the interesting things that far too few people on this earth still are unaware of. And we do our best over there to track some of the many things that are going on. And today on the program, we have Michael Tesarion back with us. We are going to conclude this six-part series that we have been doing here on Red Ice Radio. And this, of course, also means that this is our last contest. So stay tuned if you want to get your hands on the remaining DVD from Michael Tesarion's brilliant series, Origins and Oracles. And I want to pick up where we last left off, and we were talking about the great Masonic secret, the 12 tribes of Israel. Who are the carpenters in the Bible, and does that word suggest something else? And Michael also briefly mentioned Sarah, another name or another title. What's that all about? So there's a bunch of material to get to. So let's bring on our guest and get this show started. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you, Henrik. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, excellent. We have a bunch of stuff there I mentioned in the intro. And where would you like to begin?
Well, first I'd like to say that the good news is that, you know, making excellent progress on the new book, and I'm really sure that it's going to be out within maybe the next couple of months.
And this is
by the end of the year, we will have the first draft of the Irish Origins of Civilization. So anybody who's been diligently following what we've been talking about here is going to have the final product in their hands, you know, before the year's out, so that they can actually have direct access to this information.
Excellent.
Because remember, one of the things is it's great for us to be able to talk about it anecdotally, but it takes us another level for people to be able to really have it in their hands and then be able to read it and really start to use it in their daily life to find out, okay, this is not just ancient history here. This is a key that helps me see through the delusion of the lies that are being told from the synagogues, from the churches, from the Sunday schools, and from the tele-evangelists. I don't have to tell people in America about that because they know, if they've been watching the television and if they're aware of what's going on, just how powerful this new evangelist movement has been becoming after the rise to power of George Bush. You know, for 10 or 15 years, the evangelist movement in America has had to stay pretty silent because there were so many exposures of frauds, and people were just, you know, trying to move on in life and in also philosophy.
Yeah.
But now they're back again. And because they're back, we're having reinfused into our society all the old lies, all the old fakery that once was exposed back in the 1980s by brilliant people. Now it's back out again. And people are being fooled into all of this nonsense. So when you listen to evangelists in this country talking about Messiah, when you say that he's going to be coming through the clouds, when you hear them talking about that he'll be riding a white horse, or that he'll have the crown on his head, you know, and all this other symbolism, and Christians believe that this is from the Bible. This is, you know, iconography or symbolism that comes from traditional Judaism and comes from the Bible.
Yeah.
You gotta be telling them that, look, we don't mind you being a Christian, and we are not involving ourselves in your personal devotion. We actually pity you because you are involved in absorbing lies which are not good for your system.
Yeah.
We pity the average Jew who's been sacrificed on the altars of the Zionists. So, you know, the last show, we got to sort of recapture what our motive is here to tell people that we're not Christian bashing, we are not Jew bashing. What we're doing is we're taking pity on those people
who
have deep desire to connect to the divine, but do not know that they are funding and supporting and giving their money to those people whose job it is to divide you from the divine.
Exactly.
Okay, so we are not just idle, you know, punks who got nothing better to do on a Sunday night than to come on and, you know, be slamming, you know, like usual counterculture rebels do.
Yeah, exactly.
People who watch my web stream on the You've seen the web stream, right? The 2012, The Future of Mankind thing in Los Angeles?
It is brilliant, Michael. It's excellent.
And how many times do I say on that, how many times do I critique the rebel?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So, you know, if we were just rebels, then why would I be critiquing that kind of Burning Man, you know, kind of usual rebel-type countercultural person that you meet in the streets? Why would I be doing that if I'm in the same category?
Exactly.
Or if you, Henrik, were in the same category?
Yeah.
We're not in the same category. We can argue with the best of them. We can have the greatest scholars in Egyptology. We can have the greatest scholars in the movement of races and tribes. We can have the anthropologists. We can have the students of the megaliths. We can have the students of language. And we will learn a lot from them.
Indeed.
But they will also learn a lot from us.
Yes.
Because we have observed that which is out of the box. Our thinking is out of the box. And a lot of times these other people's thinking is not out of the box. It's a regurgitation of what they've learned from within the system.
Yeah.
Now, when people are holding the Irish origins of civilization in their hands, it's going to be the same thing is happening to them when they held Atlantis, alien visitation, and genetic manipulation in their hands.
Yeah.
You're going to be reading a book by somebody like them, who's come, you know, from the streets, who's made a thorough research all his life, all these subjects, and who's come to conclusions which are radically different than those conclusions which, you know, thinking in the box brings you.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah, it's going to be great to get a copy of the book. I got to buy it because it's I've been following your works now for so long, and it feels like, you know, it's you're taking it to new levels all the time. So it's going to be fascinating to see it. So great. I'm glad to hear that it's going well.
Well, I'm a big fan of the old stuff. You know, if something's been put down in a book form or something's been put down on a CD or DVD, then leave it there and move on, add something new. So this is, just as like everything in life, the human mind must continue to explore. I don't have all the answers, so, there's constant exploration.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know this, but, you know, I have contacts throughout the world who send me a lot of material that I use in my books. It's not just me working this stuff out. I get, you know, emails from people who this, who've also been researching this all their lives from Australia, and from Scandinavia, from Finland, from different parts of America. People have had little pieces of this, but they haven't known what to do with it because they don't have the whole time to do the rest of the study.
Hmm.
They hear me, and I say, hey, Michael, could use this. And then it's collaborative. What I'm trying to say is that this work is very much collaborative. And also about people like yourself, you know, taking it seriously and then giving the window of opportunity to go further and broadcast it. Again, you know, that would be more limited.
Yeah. Michael, you are from my part here. You're breaking up a bit. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Okay, so if I go blank here, I mean, just carry on. We're going to try to figure out on our end if there's something we can do here. But let's go into the topics and I mean, as I said, we mentioned last time the great Masonic secret and the 12 tribes of Israel and the carpenters and. Even Sarah, I mean, that name, and is there something here you'd like to begin with?
Yeah, well, what we have to understand is that the Bible was written, many people know that the Bible has some sort of coding in it. You know, the people who studied the Dead Sea Scrolls discovered that the Bible, the Torah, the Talmud, all of these scriptures contain code. People who've been into numerology have discovered that there's numerological codes. Other people who are into symbolism have discovered that there's kind of cryptic symbolic, almost Kabbalistic, you know, meanings in the Bible that, you know, are being brought to light.
Yeah.
So, and I agree on the same thing. What I'm trying to say is that these names, even the people in the Bible, most of them did not exist. Most of the events that are portrayed in the Bible didn't happen. The Bible was written hundreds and hundreds of years after the events that is said in the Bible happened. Hundreds of years after those dates is when these things occurred. We also know that the Bible was written in Rome. Or at least the compilation of the Old Testament and the writing of the New Testament was under the auspices of Rome.
Yeah.
So then why would the Romans and these people be interested in old world personalities? What would have fixated them with all of their gods and all of the 100 cults? You know, we should stop here and say that you can get online and you can buy books on the 100 cults of the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
There's books even with titles like that. With all of the different cults that existed in Rome and in Greece,
yeah,
and in Phoenicia, and all over the world, what on earth would possess Roman scholars like Paul and all of the people backing him to be interested in some wacko jacko Middle Eastern hodgepodge, totally incomprehensible, complex, you see, Jewish mythology.
Yeah.
Well, my answer to that, Henrik, is nothing would have possessed him to be interested in that. That's later on, we have our focus being artificially directed to the Holy Land, to this man Jesus, and to his, you know, disciples and their strange wanderings around these cities that, you know, didn't even exist. And when the Dead Sea Scrolls were dug up, they don't find a single mention of Jesus or his disciples or any of these events. When they deal with all the historians, both Jewish and Roman at the time, who were meticulous in their details of everything that happened, in the chapters where they're talking about the Middle East, they don't even mention Judea, let alone mention Jesus. So when you're reading about these characters, especially in the Old Testament, you have to realize that these are not characters who existed during the time that we're told that they existed.
Yeah.
They're not even characters that existed at all during the time that they said they existed. Once that is made clear, then we can move on. And then what you discover is two things. There's two main theories. I have to explain this because I come out on one side of the dialectic that I'm going to explain.
Okay.
It is now concluded, or most scholars are now looking into these two possibilities. One is that they think that the characters of the Bible, that's both the New Testament and the Old Testament, are analogs to Roman families who existed at the time.
Mm.
Okay, like Titus and Vespasian and the Herods. And they say that the Jesus Christ, you see, comes from that milieu. He comes from the royal families of Judea.
Yeah.
He was a person who had political, you know, standing as a rebel leader or what have you.
Hmm.
The whole story is that, yes, they did exist, but not in anything like the way it's described in the Bible. So we have to revise that. These are people who came from within the royal elite families of Messianic Judaism and also from within Rome. And it's a matter of decoding these names so that people can understand that these are like figures on a chessboard or like pictures in a silhouette movie in which these are, you know, puppets.
Yeah.
And the names are slightly changed. So could it be that Joseph of Arimathea is really Joseph ben Matthias of the house of Maccabee? The famous royal family of Judea, you see? Matthias, you take out, you just change the words a little bit around of the Jewish Matthias, and you get Amathea.
Yeah.
All right?
Interesting.
Now, you see, people need to listen to this very carefully, because if you do something like that, and it does start to sound legitimate, my goodness, you've just rewritten vast amounts of history.
Yeah, indeed.
And Henrik, they do say that Pontius Pilate's wife was a sympathizer with Jesus. And was a closet Christian, do they not?
Yeah.
You see, they do talk about that in Jewish law, you can have a substitute to go and die for you rather than you go to die. If you're one of the elite families, that's when you have that whole story that Christians will recognize of the Roman procurator saying that, hey, Jesus, you know, asking the Jewish people, do you want Barabbas instead?
Yeah, yeah.
And later people have found out that Barabbas is just a word meaning son of the rabbi. So the Bible is full of hints and codes and nuances.
Yeah.
And people have a healthy interest to find out, maybe we're being told something about the political wranglings of the time.
Yeah.
And that it's a much more interesting story to decode the characters and find out who their analogs were, who was really saying what. And there's great scholars that I hope people will read, like Joseph Atwell and Tony Bushby. You know, people need to research these people.
Yeah.
Then there's another theory that we've been going into in the last six programs, which is that, look, okay, these characters did not exist in the era A.D., when we're told, between A.D. 0 and A.D. 40, but maybe some of them appear to be based on characters 1,400 years earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know this because Ahmed Osman and Mustafa Gadala and Ralph Ellis have pointed this out and done a fantastic work in the etymology, in the philology, to show you that this might be true. But even if you don't read their books or even read my book, people know that from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're talking about the great Messiah being called Joshua, but Joshua was the right-hand man of Moses 1,400 years earlier. So when you go, Henrik, to the Jewish scriptures, the closest proximity to the man known as Jesus lived 1,400 years earlier, and the man that was worshipped as the teacher of righteousness was sacred to all the sects of the broken away from the central temple.
Mm.
So these are the hardest core Jews that you can imagine on the face of the earth. When you actually dig up their documents, which only took place in 1948, if you want to believe it, they're telling you that they already know that the Messiah, the teacher of righteousness, the man that they consider to be the star, the one worth following, the one who's going to come and set them free, is 1400 years before. Now, that is so intriguing. So the second line of study, which fascinates me, is that could it not be that these people are from that, you know, as bizarre as it sounds, can go back 1400 years. Now, here's the trick. You go back 1400 years, and you run right smack into something that happened during those era, which is far more interesting than any of this, you know, hogwash concerning the Bible. You come smack into the middle of the exile of Akhenaten of the 18th dynasty of Egypt. And you come right up smack to the middle of the greatest change astrologically that was taking place in Egypt to all the priests, which is the moving of the sun from the sign of Taurus into the sign of Aries. And we could have volume after volume after volume, because I've gone into a DVD 8 hours long to try and explain about astrotheology what these kinds of astrological changes signified. But the last one of any importance for the last 2,000 years is not the coming of Jesus Christ. But before that was the great move of the sun from one age into the other age, which caused enormous havoc, not only to Egypt. People can realize that the people who kept the temples in Egypt, the priests who worshipped every aspect of the stars, they realized that they had to script an entire new religion, an entire new set of symbols. You don't worship the bull anymore. We worship the lamb and the ram. What we have to understand, we not only understand that Egypt was, you know, in the midst of enormous dynastic and symbolic changes, Henrik, but this also affected the people who later are known as the 12 tribes of Israel. Because the 12 tribes of Israel are nothing more than exiled Egyptians. That's why you hear about the exiles taking with them cows and camels and carts and jewelry and gold, so that when they finally get to the Mount Sinai, they can create for themselves a golden calf. Can you tell me how slaves who are being booted out of any country can suddenly be building golden calves?
That's a good question.
Why are they not building the golden rat? Or the golden peacock? Or the golden moose? Why the golden calf? It's because, just like they're telling you in coded language in the Bible, these are people who are backsliding from the worship of Ares, which is what Moses, Akhenaten, wants them to do, but he's up on the mountain talking to God. What do they all do? They all backslide and go, listen, we're finished with this lunatic. We want to, I think the gods are angry with us because we've made the change, so we're going to build a golden calf and start worshiping it. Because we want to go back to the old cult of Amun-Ra, the bull god, which has been worshipped in Egypt for millions of, you know, for thousands of years. This is the god that matters. This Akhenaten and his madcap god, I think we're getting into trouble. Then down comes Moses, or in comes Akhenaten, and goes, what are you guys doing? And the Bible reports that he's thinking that they're all hedonistic and perverse. That's not true. The perversity is in the fact that they've gone to re-worship the old gods. And compels them, forces them, to obey the astrological change.
And Michael, does this you know, connect to Mithra, and is it Nike slaying the bull?
See, Mithra, the cult of Mithras, which was is always told to us as a Roman cult, is the cult of Aton in between. In between the time that the cult of Aton were exiled to the time that they became well in with the Grecian royal families, the rich families of Greece, and the rich families of Egypt, they spawned. And when I say the word spawned, I mean that means created or, you know, gave birth to. They spawned other cults. And they hid behind these cults because they couldn't have any Egypt anymore. They didn't have their own churches anymore. And they weren't really ingratiated yet into the mainstream of civilized society yet. So in the meantime, what you have is these priests of Aton, you know, who had a lot of influence, gave rise to many of the other cults that were Egyptian in imagery, or they were pan-Egyptian, but also slightly monotheistic. You know, they were pantheistic. And the cult of Mithra, I believe, is the cult of Aton front.
Interesting.
That helped them to get involved in Egyptian society. It was probably already created by some Roman cult, but it was infiltrated by the cult of Aton, who gave it a pep. And since they knew that a lot of Roman generals and Roman procurators and Roman senators and Roman officials were involved in these cults, the cult of Aton, I believe, infiltrated itself into many of these Roman cults that had prestige. And because they had real magic. I mean, these are cult of Aton people are not just some nobodies. These are ex-pharaohs of Egypt. Believe me, they got power and they got money.
Yeah.
You know, they may not be sitting in Egypt anymore, but these people are incredibly powerful. They have the wealth of thousands of years of Egyptian scholarship behind them. They matter.
Yeah.
So when they came into Rome and Greece, especially during the Grecian times, these were big shots in Alexandria, you see. Yeah, the cult of Aton didn't go anywhere. So it hung around on the periphery. And then when Egypt basically fell during the time of the Greeks made friends not with the Amon cult. The Greeks were not big friends with the Amon cult and the regular Egyptians. They were in cahoots with the Atonists. Yeah. Because the Greeks needed somebody to run the wheel in Alexandria and the countries that they conquered in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So they gave it to the people that are called the Jews. Everybody knows in Jewish history that the Jews ran Alexandria. Or at least we're saying the people that think that they're Jews today, their ancestors, they think they're ancestors. What that really is telling us is that the Israelites and the Greeks were very good friends. Okay?
Yeah.
That's why it is known that in those days, Henrik, most Jewish families called their son Alexander.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know this, but it was a hobby, a habit, in Hellenistic times for a Jewish boy's middle name or first name to be Alex.
Interesting.
Or named after one of the generals of Alexander. Because they had such close rapport. This is something that a lot of history doesn't go into.
Yeah.
Now, if we backtrack to say, who were these Israelites? We know that these Israelites came to Mount Sinai and that they ended up dividing. I'm saying that Ralph Ellis has proven that the division of the 12 tribes into the 10 tribes of Israel and the 2 tribes of Judah is also a division based on this astrological movement. So don't just focus on Egypt and what the Egyptian priests were doing, wondering about how to build new temples and worship new gods. The exiled Egyptians also had a schism. So when your mind goes to Mount Sinai and when it's thinking about the golden calf and the falling out of the people, that's true. That happened. The 10 tribes of Israel said, we are not interested in this super Atonist, super Aries, belligerent Martian, you know, sun cult type of thing.
Yeah.
And they basically became then considered, and this is very, very important for what we're going to say in a minute. These 10 tribes then were considered lost.
Yeah.
They were considered anti-Jehovah, meaning anti-Atonist. Every Jew who's listening to this better listen up, because we're going to explain your Holocaust later on. And we're going to explain the pogroms. And we're going to explain why rich Jews have been putting you on the altars of sacrifice when you think that you should be exempt because you're Jewish. You better be listening to this, because we're going to find out why you would want to back Zionists who are massacring Palestinians. Are those Zionists really Jews? Let's go back into a bit of history and find out something interesting that you need to know about your Jewish history. And that is the 10 tribes of Israel who decided not to follow Aton and not to follow Moses, who assimilated into the West, who've been coaxed to re-follow those people now, is a lie. Because those people said, no, we're going to become westernized. We want to move and assimilate into the Western countries and have nothing to do with this. We are Jewish by conversion, and our Bible is the Torah, period. So who are these other people that are hiding under the name of Israel?
Yeah.
Who have no business doing that. They're of the house of Judah. They're loyal to Aton. They have created the Vatican. They have funded the Illuminati. They've created the Masons, and they've created the Jesuits. And they're bringing murder and mayhem to this world and under the name of Judaism and under the name of Christianity. When people say the word Judeo-Christianity, they got to find out, where did that term come from? When we're already told that after the Assyrian captivity, the tribes had so much antipathy, Henrik, towards one another, the 10 tribes followed Jeremiah into the west and became totally assimilated, bringing their various symbolism with them. And then only 2 tribes, those of Levi, that's where the word Levite comes from, and the tribe of Benjamin, went back, they say, to the temple and hung it out there and stayed true to the old oral tradition of the Talmud.
Yeah.
Later became the Talmud. But what we've got to understand is this, that division between the people was not just political in nature. It was based on an astrological change. So when Jews and Christians are telling you today that they have no time for astrology, my goodness, their very origins are based in a observation of precession and the horoscopy.
Yeah. fascinating.
So this is where we now discover something is basically considered the ending of one phase of the cult of Aton when they divided. But your question about Sarah goes back, you see, to their beginnings. At the time of Amenhotep III, who I always consider as one of the most important pharaohs outside of Akhenaten, and by the way, for Christians who have been listening to us and everyone else, Amenhotep III is Solomon. Thutmosis III, because remember we promised on this show to actually go into the dramatis personae.
Yeah.
Amenophis III is Solomon. We stop there and we say, well, then what does the word Solomon mean?
Yeah.
It means exactly the same thing as the word Saul, King Saul, later on.
Yeah.
It means son, king, son, S-U-N.
Yeah, the sun king. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, sun king. Amenhotep III happened to just be called Solomon. Well, why not? He's the sun king. He's the king of the priests. He's the king of the priests of the sun.
Yeah.
His nickname is Solomon. Nothing mysterious about it.
No, it's right there in the words.
It's a title. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the golden king. The hell they were called. It's all over their own monuments. Akhenaten, the very first word, Akka, or Ikka, means the eye, the golden eye.
Ah.
James Bond and his golden eye?
Yeah.
Who is the golden eye?
Yeah.
What's going on in these movies? So, they're all sun kings. So if the Bourbon king, Louis the 16th, is calling himself the sun king, let's find out why. Now, Sarah is meant to be in the Bible. If you go by the Bible, which I told people have already been saying is not a great legitimate source or anything, but at least in the Bible it's saying that Abraham's wife, Sarah, gets involved with the Pharaoh. The true story is that Abraham himself was a Pharaoh.
Yeah.
He was the Pharaoh of the northern part of Egypt. His group had taken over a couple of hundred years before. They were very ruthless. But what happened to them was that there was a drought. Northern Egypt was hit by a very severe drought, and the waters receded. And they couldn't feed their people. Whereas the waters of the Nile, they are starting in the south, down in Africa.
Yeah,
further
yeah.
down is where the waters of the Nile are the richest and the purest and the cleanest. So the southern Egypt was not affected by any drought. But the king of the south of Egypt that hated the guts of Abraham and the northern Hyksos dynasty pharaohs, you see? But, you see, of course, what happened was Abraham went with his people and he took his wife and they begged the southern pharaoh for help, saying all of Egypt is suffering, you can't let people die, you know. So what happened is the southern pharaoh gave them grain. In the meantime, they claim that the southern pharaoh fell in love with Sarah. And the Bible blatantly tells you that when the pharaoh wanted Sarah, Abraham lied and said that she is my sister, you can have her. When, of course, it's his wife.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I'd love to dive into the question of why this wonderful, holy man of God, this Jehovah's great patriarch, would be lying through his black teeth. How holy that can be, but we'll have to leave that one aside. People can make up their own minds about that one. It's just pretty much, you know, it's pretty much the game. When you're dealing with the Bible, that's pretty much the rule. But, you know, let's not be so controversial. We'll come back to the story. It's amazing to me. So this is what happened. Now, here's the implication that Ahmed Osman has brought out. This means, then, that Sarah lay with the pharaoh Amenophis III and her son Isaac and his son Jacob and Joseph. And isn't it that Jacob was renamed Israel? Yeah.
Interesting.
So then the 12 tribes of Jacob, or the 12 tribes of Israel, hey, their granddaddy is Amenophis III, the pharaoh. There it is, and it's absolutely irrefutable. So even if people do not believe all the other sundry connections to Egypt, you see, and they turn that all down, and they believe there's no such connection, and it can't be proven, well, listen, there is absolute 100% proof. And that's the reason, by the way, why you have not seen so much recently on Egypt. Because since the work of Ahmed Osman, there's been a sort of a silence in the Egyptian community. Because they don't want to touch upon any of this. Because this man, Osman, has proven that the Yuya, the character known as Yuya, who was the caretaker of Akhenaten, his uncle, actually not his uncle, his grandfather, was the Joseph that is talked about in the Bible. Again, a descendant of Sarah and Amenophis III. So when you want to examine the dramatis personae of the Bible, they are finding out now that Akhenaten connects to Moses, that there is a similarity between Yuya and Joseph. The words are the same, by the way. When you go back into Egyptian, the word Jacobim or Jacobam are very similar to the Joseph, who is known as the grandfather or the caretaker of Akhenaten.
But, Michael, do you think that this kind of information that you're presenting here is known, for example, within the higher degrees of within the Masonic, Freemasonic world, so to speak?
Yes. In fact, I believe that Masonry is one of its major functions. It has two major functions symbolically. One is to keep preserved exactly what we're revealing today.
Mm.
I can reveal this stuff because I've never been a Mason, and I've just used my own brains and my own wit to read Masonic literature, which I have a large collection, and to read, I've always studied ancient Egypt and marked these X factors.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, the Masonic symbolism that is used, the symbol of the sun, the symbol of the pyramid, the symbol of the eagle, these are Egyptian symbols, and they are to keep that.
Yeah.
And
the,
one of the most important other roles of Freemasonic history is to preserve the teachings of the Druids. Because the Druids are older than the Egyptians. And they, in fact, Egyptian culture owes a debt, just like the world owes a debt, to the Druids of Ireland, who were the first makers of keepers of civilization.
Yeah.
So Masonry contains a great deal of Druidic symbolism that they often make you believe, falsely, is Judaic symbolism.
Yeah, yeah.
It is Judaic because the word Judah meant a Druid.
Really?
Yeah, well, the word Judah and the word judge, we still use the word Jew today and the word judge.
Yeah, indeed.
But a judge is not a man of a race. A judge is just an extremely intelligent, articulated, matriculated person, right?
Mm, yeah.
Of high intelligence. So the Jew meant nothing more, and this has to be taken exactly as I'm saying it. The word Jew only meant smart man.
Oh, okay.
Educated man, man from the temples, man who has the knowledge of herbalism, medicine,
and
metaphysics,
and
prophecy, music, and of course, religion.
And this gives them, do you inquire that this gives them also the power to judge other people then?
Yes.
All right.
It means that they can interfere in their lives, both in legal, they have legal ability, they have educators, they're educators, and they're educators, you see, so yes. It meant a person of great standing who was a great person in knowledge. It's only a hijacking of words, which Conor McAdari went blue in the face, telling people to watch out for that, is that, look, the hijacking of certain terms and the misappropriation of terms.
Yeah.
Now, Henrik, it's very easy for, in the AD 40, it's very, very easy, is it not, to come along to people who are poor, who are desperate, and who are conquered, living, scratching a living in the Golan Heights or in Galilee somewhere, and say, don't you know you guys are the descendants of the Messiah? And you're all of, you know, royal blood? Of course people want to believe that.
Yeah, of course.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean they are. Doesn't mean that they have any rank.
Yeah.
But you tell a very, very, disgruntled people who are not even worthy to be written up in even the histories that the Messiah is going to come from amongst you. And that you're God's holy chosen people, the Jews. They don't even know how to read.
Yeah, you talked about this earlier. I mean, this is basically, as you said, these are, people in the fields who basically perhaps don't know what's going on in that sense. And so easy to cling to such an idea because I guess it would be very empowering for them, right?
Especially if some big shot is telling you from one of your own royal families.
Yeah.
If somebody has been employed, like we know that Josephus was a Jew who started working for the royal for the Caesars, so it's easy to do.
Yeah.
So some Herod or somebody from a semi-legitimate upper-class family who's working for the Romans behind the veil, comes and starts to preach the fact that all you people are the holy chosen ones that Jehovah picked, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to believe the same thing today. When you tell a Christian Jesus died for your sins, hey, it's easy to do.
Yeah.
The delusion hasn't gone away, Henrik. The people are still laboring under the illusion, the grotesque illusion that your personal toxicity and your personal sins, that you don't have to do anything, but some other guy died for that all, and you believe it?
That is interesting.
Well, back then, you can come to some disgruntled people who are, you know, being highly oppressed and who've lost their identity, who've got this complex priestarchy, who are talking endlessly about the Midrash and the Torah and the Talmud. It's so convoluted that it's losing its grip on the people. And already the Jewish people have divided into countless sects.
Yeah.
There's no cohesion anymore. They all, and all the sects, despise the central temple. The religion has become null and void. It has no central nexus whatsoever. So much so that the powers that be decide that they have to create a new religion, i.e. Christianity.
Yeah.
We can understand why all of this stuff happened.
So,
what the hell is going on?
Yeah, exactly. What the hell is going on? And do you think that the, you know, the Council of Nicaea? I guess we briefly touched upon this earlier. But do you think that this is just kind of a, you know, a renewal of this old legend? Then.
Yes. What happened was that the high-level Levites, who are Sadducees and Pharisees, I mean, these words in the end of the day don't really mean anything.
Yeah.
But these very high-level families in Judea who had their eyes set on the West. Of course they had their eyes set on the West. That's where all the money was coming from. That's where all the civilized nations of the world lived.
Yeah.
My goodness, they've just been conquered for the last 1,000 years by either Greeks or Romans who live a high life in the West.
Mm.
So you're tinkering around in the devil. You're not interested in your lower class people who are pottering around fishing on the banks of the Sea of Galilee. Those are people they're like considered complete and utter, you know, riffraff to you.
Yeah.
Mm. Your daughters are being educated in Rome. They're marrying Roman generals, for goodness sake. People, wake up. These high-level so-called Israelite families that happened to live, if they ever did, in Palestine, the Maccabees, the Herods, and many of these other rich families that nobody ever wants to tell you about. These educated ones were only interested in ingratiating themselves with Rome. Rome is interested in doing that because that helps them to keep peace in the area by hiring these quislings to keep order.
Yeah.
I mean, this is simple tactics that anybody knows, that when you conquer a place, you put the rich families in there, right, and you make them privileged.
Yeah, of course.
It's in American history, it's in any kind of history. So the liaisons between these elite people. And I believe that on the Roman side, and possibly on the Judaic side, this is where the cult of Aton was operating.
Mm.
It's my personal belief that the Pisos of Rome and the Flavian family of Rome were either descended by blood from the Aton family, or at least were converts.
Ah.
And so they got together with the Sadducees, specifically, who are recognized. Jewish people will understand what I'm saying if they've really done their homework. They'll know all about the Sadducees and how friendly they are with the Romans.
Yeah.
And they came up with the nexus of the idea of Roman Catholicism. And it was going to be in Rome, not Judea. If it was a purely Israelite idea, Henrik, then the church would have been in Jerusalem.
Oh.
It cannot be overstated why the first converts to religion are Roman. And it cannot be overstated why the first church of Rome is in Rome, for goodness sake.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Now, the way that they cover that up, because of course they know that people are going to ask these questions. When people like me, researchers, ask these questions, they always have an answer. The answer is that St. Peter traveled to Rome early on and died there, was killed there, and it's over the bones of St. Peter, the rock, the stone that Jesus had said, you're going to build my church, to St. Peter the rock, whose name was once Cephas, and then it became, you know, Petra, over his body. So they actually did find a couple of burnt out bones, like some goat has dropped dead, and they said, this dead goat is the bones of St. Peter. Quick, build a temple.
Yeah.
So the Rome is built over some spurious bones that they probably dug out of a local graveyard somewhere. And they had all the dignitaries from all around the world come and give them billions of dollars, which I've written about on my website, and it's going to be in the new book, explaining how Rome rose.
Yeah.
From all the chumps who believed that they couldn't get to heaven unless they had come to the place where St. Peter died. Like Jesus did say in the Bible, hey, Peter, you know, the church will be built on you. But he didn't say they're going to come and pay money to see your bones. You know, Jesus missed out all that stuff.
Yeah.
Now, here's the trick, which we've been laboring to explain. If the Church of Rome was so Judaic then why does it not believe what the apostles of Jesus were teaching throughout the world, which is that a man goes about with no script and no purse and believes in poverty and the equality of all men? Does it look to you like Rome believes in poverty? How come it is, if the Rome is based on the old apostolic system, that they're so wealthy? And secondly, why all the regalia, architecture, symbolism is Egyptian in nature?
Yeah.
So if anybody had any doubt, or people like me are talking about, because I agree it is kind of convoluted, it's not taught to you in regular schools, it does sound a bit of heresy.
Yeah.
But then let me ask you a simple question. How come that the symbolism they're using is not Judaic, it is not of Jesus? The Pope is not basing himself on Jesus, the teachings of Jesus.
No.
He's based on Akhenaton, the sun priests of the temples of Heliopolis, Amarna, Avaris, Alexandria.
Yeah.
And anybody who's done 5 minutes of homework knows that, because they're showing you that.
Indeed.
And if there's 13 obelisks.
Yeah,
six
exactly.
Geometry and all the artists that were there. The city is laid out that way.
Yeah.
There's Maltese crosses. There's skulls and bones. There's triple tiaras from Babylon. The thing is incredibly Egyptian and Babylonian in nature. Has got very little to do with bona fide what Jews think is their symbolism. Only what Jews have got to realize, and I hope they will realize this, is that their symbolism is also Egyptian and Celtic in origin. And that the stories in the Bible that try to teach you as a Jew that it's not Celtic and Egyptian in origin are forgeries and are created by scholars, what we call church bishops, like the Bishop of Hippo, right, that later was St. Augustine. And these people, the bishops of these places, the Bishop of Caesarea, the Bishop of Ireland, the Bishop of Hippo, you see, the Bishop of Rome, they commissioned historians to sit down and make it appear that the symbols and all the rest of the stories originated in Palestine.
Yeah.
Cut out all the Irish crap. Cut out all the Egyptian crap, or you're going to lose your head.
Yeah.
By the way, we don't care how absolutely stupid your stories are.
Just make something up that works.
In fact, most of them were stupid. Most of these monks who had the ability to write had not traveled anywhere, had no understanding of Egyptian history or even Jewish history. So when you're reading the Bible and it makes no sense at all, and when the four Gospels can't even agree on what day Jesus was crucified, they can't even agree what city he was in when the opening of the tomb.
Yeah.
They can't even decide what part of the world that was in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People can go to page 5 of my astrotheology page and start reading from the top to the bottom and come back and tell me that it looked like these people who wrote the Bible knew what the hell was going on. All right?
Yeah.
It's because these are local guys from Minneapolis, you know, or from St. Paul, or from flicking Gothenburg there, who never left. You know? You're picking a guy from Malmo who's never left Malmo going, okay, tell me all about Egypt. You sit down and here's a story about Egypt. And you script this so it doesn't look like it's about Egypt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's going to do a pretty shoddy job.
Indeed.
So we have a shoddy job in front of us. The people like me who've done more research can look into and go, wait a minute, I'll not only be able to deconstruct this incredible lie, I'll be able to show you what was here in its place.
Yeah.
Because, Henrik, I am not a person who's just interested in deconstruction. I'm not only interested in being able to break down something that's standing. I'm also interested in showing people what beautiful, pristine thing stood here in its place.
Yeah. Yeah, and what really happened, I mean.
Right.
Because that's what we're asking here, so.
Now, Sarah, Nefertiti, you see, the great queens, Cleopatra, there was a huge cult of the goddess. When Catholicism was born, it was born from Rome. That is why you know that the Roman elite and the Jewish elite, you know that it was part Israelite in nature, because the goddess worship was highly scaled back. That already shows you that it's sun cult. If anybody wanted any proof that this is sun cult from Egypt, notice the fact that the underworld cycle is cut out, meaning that they do not worship life after death. The cult of Osiris and the cult of what's going to happen to you after you die was removed by Akhenaten as having no importance whatsoever. They didn't even honor any of that. Plus, they also, because it's a masculine worship of the sun, the goddess factor is way downplayed.
So
when you see the two same things, and these, by the way, are only two things I'm pointing out, when you see that there's less emphasis on the goddess and there's no emphasis on the underworld cycle ritual, which were sacred to all pagan people, then you know that you're talking atonism. And I don't care if it's called Christianity or Judaism. It's atonism, because Aton was the first god that said, it's only me, and you don't care about after death, and you don't care about the goddess. There's only me, the masculine, Yahwistic concept. So this is proof that atonism is Christianity. Then the Roman Catholic Church realized that it wasn't happening. When you descale, when you marginalize the feminine, people don't like it, especially pagan people. You're moving in first gear. So then they decided at the Council of Ephesus, or Ephesus, the place, to better bring in or better permit the worship of the female person, Mary.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you know that there was cheering in the streets all around Rome and all around the empire when that decree was made? Because people wanted that. And in the first 20 years that the decree that you can now worship Mary as a bona fide part of the Holy the Trinity, she's acceptable. All the groves, temples, and shrines to every goddess, from Sibyl to Hera to Aphrodite, you see? To Diana, all over the world, was instantly converted to a Christian church. And many times, the shrines were still called Mary Aphrodite.
Oh, really?
In Latin.
Yeah.
They even still kept the name of the old place. This is how dumb people can be. That they didn't care. They converted the shrines of their goddesses to the worship of the Mary. So what I'm trying to say is that Rome has just got a box of tricks. That it is stolen from the old Israelite pharaohs of Egypt.
Yeah.
That it's stolen from the cult of Mithras and from Serapis and from the Osiris cult and from the Celtic druids. And I don't care if anybody believes this or not.
So
Rome has a box of tricks, and when they find out that this part is not working, they can pull out another one and go, okay, we'll allow this now.
Yeah, and as the word implies, Catholic is that is the first attempt to create this universal religion, right? One religion for everyone on the entire planet.
That's right.
Yeah. Michael, not to cut you off here, but are you ready to fire away a question for our contest before we leave today?
Give me a few more minutes with that.
Okay, all right, okay, sure.
I had it, and I'm just looking to make sure that it's easy for people to find.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, because, you know, as I said, Catholicism is the, that is the new world order religion, basically. But do you think that it's failed, or do you think now when people are returning to it, as you said in the beginning, that it's basis, that is, it is a success? What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think it's successful. I think they've, you know, because they've put millions of dollars into it.
Yeah.
You know, these are very, very powerful people, and who have they got standing up against them? Very few people. They have created the universities and the colleges and the seminaries and the schools to teach you the lies that I'm trying to expose.
Yeah.
And the people like Ralph Ellis and other writers are exposing. But we're only a handful of people, Henrik.
Yeah, exactly.
And even when we open our mouths, I don't need to tell you what, you know, I mean, I'm lucky. I don't know why, but people seem to take to what I'm saying all over the world, so I don't have too much of a problem. But I say, you know, a lot of times there's been a lot of resistance. I think that the resistance is getting less.
Yeah.
So the only thing positive I see is that people are starting to want more of these truths. And the reason is this. They're so sick of the lies. You know how a junkie will say that they clean up, and when you ask them why they cleaned up or why an alcoholic cleaned up, one of the first things that they'll tell you is because they got sick of being sick?
Yeah.
That's the same thing when it comes to disinformation. Some people are so sick of ignorance, so sick of being disempowered, so sick of being told lie after lie after lie, that they finally now, not through passion and not through truth, they're coming to seek for the truth, but just because they want something different. They are so burned out on the same vomit that they've been swallowing all these years.
Yeah, exactly.
That strange quirk of nature, I don't know what it is, it's a strange quirk of human fate or human nature, that you might then, you know, come back and do some cold turkey and say, well, look, is there somebody who can explain all of this? Do you know, I was in the same boat not too long ago.
Yeah.
It's Jordan Maxwell, you see, and Eustace Mullins and these people who have awakened me.
Yeah.
Because I was in the same boat. I had no clue. I had some of these pieces because I'd been a student of goddess tradition long before this, and a student of film and a student of symbolism and astrology and whatnot, and I had so many parts that didn't connect. The difference is with me is that I start making notes of all of those things that didn't connect.
Yeah.
But you see, the great hubris, the enormous ego of these people. Yeah, if you talk to them, they're doing real well. They consider themselves to be in complete control of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, no, yeah. Time is moving fast again here, Michael. We have, you know, about four minutes left. Not to get too distracted by the question, we can do, you know, we can announce it later on the site if you're not able to get to it right now. Okay.
No, I think I can give you one. I'm just trying to get something simple.
Okay. All right.
It's the last one, isn't it?
It is. That's correct.
Okay. I was just trying to find it though. I couldn't remember where it was.
Okay. I can mention before we go on here that.
How long have we actually got there?
We got about three minutes. So.
Oh dear, it's very short.
It is.
Yeah, why don't I send you something this time? We'll not do it live.
Yeah, let's do that. Everyone listening, I mean, I can just mention that you can mail me the answer to this address, radio@redicecreations.com, and we will get all the information up on the site, www.red-ice.net, and we want to get that last DVD out. So.
Oh, I got it. Here, I've got the question.
Okay, all right, there we go.
The question is, what is the motto of the Jesuit College? Jesuit order.
Ah, all right, there we go. And let's say
the Jesuits are, in my opinion, a key group that is a descendant, either ideologically or even physically, from the cult of Aton, and they have a most intriguing motto that is basically of their order. And if people can find out what that is, they can make the choice. They can have the last DVD.
Excellent. And let's take that answer through mail, because it's too short to get to the phones here, I think. So, Michael, I just want to say here also that this series has been excellent. And I mean, we got about, you know, 6 hours now of excellent information surrounding all of these elements that we have been talking about. So, I mean, I want to thank you very much for bringing this out, and I encourage everyone to get their hands on the new book and tell us, Michael, when how will people be able to get that?
You know, just keep contacting me for updates. Keep visiting the michaeltessarian.com website.
Yeah.
It's not ready yet, but we're making excellent progress. You know, and it will be out. You know, before the end of the year. That's my only thing, my guarantee I can say.
Mm.
I also want to thank you personally, Henrik, because as you can see, as everyone who's listened to the series that we've done can see, this is not subject matter that could ever be covered in one show.
Yeah.
When we say that this stuff is too, you know, long to go into, we mean that, but not every radio host will give you the time then to take you up on that and say, okay, then we'll do a series.
Yeah.
So, you know, I cannot extend enough thanks to you for doing this so that people can have a thorough encyclopedic knowledge of this whole question of the cult of Aton.
Yeah.
So when we find out that the Masons are saying, Per me regnus regnant, through me kings will reign, right? That we see the status quo in the world out there of who are these potentates and these kings and who's behind them.
Yeah.
They mean what they say. They do serve somebody else.
Indeed.
You know what the motto for the Pope is, one of his titles? Servant
no.
of the servants of God.
Uh-huh. All right.
The Pope's title is Servant of the servants of God. Who are the servants of God?
Yeah.
Who are those who say, before Pope, we stand? You're not just to have a direct medium to the God through the church or through the Pope. The Pope has a medium that he goes through. Who would that be? We are here to expose to you who has the fingers crossed behind the back, who is these secret societies. And it's very important to start getting this because we're a new opposition.
Yeah.
You know, this is a very new subject. It's not very old. It dates from the, you know, the time of Eustace Mullins and G. Edward Griffin.
Yeah.
It's a very young study, and we need to have the facts quick because these people are bringing the blades down on the necks of the human race. So, Henrik, from my heart to your heart goes out to thanks, you know, for you exploring this matter with me. Very, very important. And you'll be the first person to get a copy of the new book, believe me.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you so much. And, I mean, onward and upwards, and let's stay in contact. And, again, thank you so much, Michael. Let's conclude
right,
there.
And take it easy.
We'll talk later. Bye, Michael. Bye. Yeah, another excellent show with Michael Tessarion. Do check out his website, michaeltessarion.com or taroscopes.com, and look out for the his upcoming new book. So, all right, this has been Henrik Palmgren coming to you live from the west coast of Sweden, and you have been listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm signing off, and we will continue the show next week. Okay, bye-bye, everyone.